Thanks for attending the session this afternoon. My name is Ray Davis, and I'm the Technical Documentation Manager for Medtronic, our Global Service Operations Group. My TechCom team is responsible for writing service and repair instructions for some of the large surgical imaging and surgical navigation systems that Medtronic sells. Up more? Okay. A little better? Okay. I'm going to rewind that just a skosh. I'm the technical documentation manager for Medtronic. Man, I flubbed that twice. For our global service operations group. And so my team, my TechCom team, is responsible for writing service and repair instructions for some of the large surgical imaging and surgical navigation systems that we sell. I'm going to talk this afternoon about safety and effectiveness and how we put that into service documentation. Safe and effective normally refers to the way a medical device or a system is used, but on my team, we also extend that to how the system is repaired and serviced. Without specifics, though, it's hard for it to be anything other than a platitude. So it's important to understand what we mean and why it's important so we can have a strategy for implementing it. Let's start with a little backstory. In 2013, as a sole contributor, I was asked to create an approach to documentation that ensured consistent repair procedures. We wanted to focus on consistent procedures. Doing the same thing every time and producing consistent results, basically effectiveness. We wanted a consistent voice. Up until this point, procedures were written by manufacturing engineers and design engineers and field service engineers. I think you're sensing a pattern here. There was no consistent voice. There was no consistent use of language. And we wanted to focus on ongoing safety. As you'll see, some of these systems can be very dangerous. So we wanted to improve the safety for the engineers in the field who are working on them. The obvious choice, or at least the obvious choice to me, was topic-based authoring. In 2013, we were using Brand A, I think you know what I'm talking about, as our standard tool for documentation. In its unstructured form, which we were using, it's not necessarily the best tool in the world for topic-based authoring, and even its structured approach can be really cumbersome with a lot of overhead. Still, tool set aside, topic-based authoring was it's the right approach, but it's radically different from the traditional method of writing. So I had to sell this to management. They're asking for it, but did they really know what they were asking for? So my approach was to compare it to something that they knew and then compare it to a business process that they could understand. When I change the oil in my car, I always start the same way. I turn off the car, I lift the hood, and I wait for the engine to cool off a little bit before I get started. But I do these same things when I do other car maintenance as well. When I change the battery, and you do too, unless you have one of those fancy Euro cars that has the battery in the trunk, when you add wiper fluid, when you check the coolant level. So I ask them, if I'm doing these same things every time, shouldn't I do them the same way every time? Once they understand the oil change analogy, it's easy to make the leap and compare it to a business process, manufacturing. We're going to manufacture these procedures. In manufacturing, you create the part, and then you test the individual part. And then you assemble it into the completed whole, and then you test the completed whole. And shouldn't we take this approach with documentation? As a documentation team manufacturing procedures, we're going to create the block of content, we're going to test the block of content, and then we're going to assemble individual blocks of content into a coherent procedure, and then we're going to test the completed procedure. As a bonus, the next time we write a similar procedure, we've already written and tested most of it. So just like in the oil change analogy, we're going to be doing the same thing the same way every time. Now, because this isn't a case study, let's limit ourselves to a little bit of backstory and fast forward 2 years. We've implemented a scheme of topic-based authoring using Brand A, and it's been very effective. We're doing small bits of writing, and we're really getting some good consistency in what we're writing. But it also took almost 2 years to complete the manual. So what happened? For one thing, we really underestimated the time it would take to test everything. and we underestimated how reuse would impact those tests. When you reuse a piece of content, and you need to change that content, the first thing you have to do is find every place where that content is being used. Then you have to determine where it's being used, does it need to be retested, and then you have to retest it. As we added procedures and writers and manuals, we started learning some really hard lessons. First was that we had very little understanding of the impact of reuse or even a strategy for reuse. Our strategy was just reuse. And second, since we were just dumping everything into a Windows directory, we had to bring some sort of order to the chaos that was our reused content. And we tried to do this with a very clear, naming convention. That naming convention was a sequential serialized number tracked in a spreadsheet, by the way, a product line identifier, the component location and the content description, the content revision number, .fm. So what could go wrong? Considering that everything in our architecture was in a set of Windows directory and it was linked in with file names, everything that could go wrong did go wrong, and we ended up with this sort of Rube Goldberg content management system. In reality, we had very little reuse from product to product. We assumed that we might have as much as 75% reuse, but in reality, it was close to zero. And in fact, we had so little reuse between our product lines, we actually started referring to our documentation set as silos. I know silo is a bad word in corporate America, but it really did describe the very homogeneous nature of the content. There was lots of reuse within the individual silos and almost no reuse between the silos. When it came to safety warnings and cautions, we could reuse very general radiation and electrical safety information, but the underlying architectures of the different systems were so different that there was just nothing that transferred well between the silos. As I mentioned earlier, we underestimated the impact of reuse on testing. So as a medical device manufacturer, we operate in an environment where everything has to be tested, and there has to be clear traceability in that testing. So if you test procedures 2, 3, and 4, and you find that you have to make a change to a block of content that was reused in procedure 2, when you make that change, you've just invalidated the testing for procedure 2, and you have to go back and you have to retest that procedure. So reusing content became this ongoing nightmare of where is all the places that this content is being used. And we were constantly asking ourselves how many procedures or even documents are being impacted by this change, and do we need to retest it every time we make these changes? You'll see how Flare actually supports the product silo approach. When you think silo, think project. And all the content from a product line lives in a project. So each manual in the project has access to all of the reusable content. In 2016, we converted our entire documentation set from Brand A over to MadCap Flare. There were 3 writers, 4 if you include myself, 7 product lines, 65 documents in the wild, a little better than 1,300 discrete pieces of reusable content. In 2017, we published a fair number of pages. I think it's an impressive number. I thought it was an impressive number, and then I came here, and I listened to what everyone else is doing, and now I'm not so sure that it's that impressive. But I want to save it to the end because I'm kind of impressed with it. So what does our implementation look like today? We're using MadCap Flare 2017. We use high-definition digital cameras to record procedures. This is our gold standard. It allows us to capture procedures as the engineer is performing them and describing them, and we can take photos in the moment while they're going through the procedures, and in a pinch, we can even use screen captures from videos for our illustrations in our documents. We're using Adobe Photoshop and Illustrator for image prep and capture for callout numbers, and then it all sits on top of an SVN repository that was left over from our previous architecture. Safe and effective definitely sound like a good idea, but from a practical standpoint, it's essential, especially given that the systems that we work with can really hurt you. So let's take a quick look at what my team is writing about, and you'll have a better idea of why safe and effective is important. If you know the name Medtronic, you most likely know it in association with pacemakers and heart valves and what are called in the vernacular pain pumps. These are some of the other products that you might be familiar with but didn't know that we manufacture. We also manufacture some products that you might not be familiar with. These are large capital systems that are they're marketed to surgeons and to hospitals. As an example, this is the Fusion ENT surgical navigation system. The Stealth Station S8 navigation system. This is another optical image, or it's an optical image-guided surgical navigation system. And then this is the O-arm surgical imaging system. So full disclosure, if you want to hear some cool stuff about how these systems are used, that's not this presentation. I'm not allowed by my company to describe usage. You have to have special training for that, so even though I understand it, I can't talk about it. But I did want to give you an idea of what these big systems look like so that you have some context as we describe how we go about servicing and repairing them. One thing that I can say about the Stealth Station S8 is that it is super heroic. And I can say this because it's not a usage issue. This is a screen capture from the 2016 Marvel Studios movie Doctor Strange. And this is at about the 5-minute mark in the movie. On the right is Benedict Cumberbatch as Dr. Stephen Strange. And on the left is our Stealth Station S8. So it's a movie star as well as being a superhero. It's a particular point of pride for me and my team that we were able to work on something, not just because it's a movie star, but because it does do some good in the world. And it's a pretty impressive system. As a medical device manufacturer, we're closely scrutinized by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or the FDA. The FDA is responsible, among other things, for safety and effectiveness in medical devices. And this is from their own website, and I think it's intentionally vague. I'm not going to tell you how we as a company define safe and effective and satisfy the FDA. We have whole departments that tell us what that means. And if you think about it like this, has anyone here recently bought a house or rented an apartment? Well, I just recently bought a house. When you do that, if you have done that in the past, you know that you sign this mountain of paperwork, right? And so a real estate attorney that I know explained it to me like this. The top sheet of paper in that mountain of paperwork, all it really says is no pay, no stay. And then everything underneath it is the various definitions of pay and the various definitions of stay. And I think that's what this is like with the FDA. They're saying safe and effective, and then you have to determine what that safe and effective is, and you have to implement it for yourself. So what does Medtronic Global Service Operations do? We're responsible for servicing and repairing those systems that I just showed you. My department specifically writes the manuals that the engineer takes into the field to do that work. We're talking about going to hospitals and other customer sites where these systems are in use. There's an important distinction to be made here. We don't write instructions for using the system. That's a different department. What we write describes repair, calibration, maintenance, and testing so that when the system is used, it performs according to its intended use. My counterpart and I, we usually draw the line at the patient. If the patient is present, the system is in use. If the patient is not present, you're probably servicing the system. And in fact, that's the first point of safety in any manual that we write. If the patient is present, you're not allowed to do any maintenance on the system. It's just not appropriate for the patient to be present. We write these instructions, and it's everything that the engineer needs to take into the field, walk up to a system where it's been parked in the corner at a hospital, effect the repair, and return it back to the customer ready for use. What's interesting about these systems, I think, is once you start taking them apart, they have more in common with industrial equipment than medical equipment. It's still an X-ray system, but it's also big and heavy with pinch points and high voltage electricity and hydraulics under pressure. And another thing to keep in mind is that the system might be malfunctioning. Or as you take the system apart, you're disabling many of the safeties that are put in place to keep the user safe while they're using the system. These are some of the common hazards that an engineer in the field faces when repairing the system. Everything from unfinished metal that can cut to high voltage electricity, ionizing radiation, and even laser emissions that can blind you literally in milliseconds. Something else to consider. As a tech writer, we're often around these systems to write and test our procedures. So the hazards that the engineer faces in the field, they're the same hazards that we potentially face in the lab. So it's even in our best interest to make sure that we get these things right. As a general statement, what do we consider safe and effective in our service documentations? Our documentation, we admonish the engineer of all hazards in all situations. We assure easy access to information in the dedicated safety sections of the manual. So this is cross-references at all points back to the general safety information. We account for common failure modes when you're repairing these systems. And this is where we really depend on the SMEs to guide us on what can go wrong and how to recover from it. And then we want to provide consistent warnings and cautions. And we have a template for these admonitions that we'll talk about in a couple of minutes, and it helps us stay consistent. Our instructions should be consistent from procedure to procedure and even product to product. So several products in the same family can share common procedures, or they can share design or repair philosophies. So your reuse is providing consistency even between products in the same family. The procedure should do what it says it does, nothing more and nothing less. We're writing procedures, not FAQs, and it should have all steps necessary to walk up to the machine, do the repair, and then return it to the customer for ready for use. And then there's a common language for tools and parts, and this is really important to us. And just to give you an example of some of the challenges that we face, who knows what this is? That's one we don't have. I'm going to come back to this because it has kind of an interesting answer, so be thinking about that. Okay, we've talked about how we got to the place where we're at, and we're reusing content, and the safety and effectiveness in our service documents. And so the question now is, how does topic-based authoring at Madcap Flare specifically promote safety and effectiveness? We talked about some of the safety hazards the engineer can face in the field. As I said, when you start taking these systems apart, sometimes you're disabling the subsystems that inherently keep the user safe during operation. And at that point, they have a lot in common with some of the larger industrial equipment. We also write admonitions, the warnings and cautions. And unlike in instructions for use, these admonitions are intended to keep the service engineer safe and the device safe, which is different from instructions for use, which are intended to keep the patient safe. Most commonly, we write two types of admonitions, a warning and a caution. A warning is an admonition that mitigates physical injury to the patient, or in this case, the operator or a bystander. And a caution is an admonition that mitigates damage to the equipment itself, to property, forfeited time, or the need to abort the use of the system. We looked previously at some of the more common hazards that are faced in the field. To be honest, high voltage electricity is the one that scares me the most, and these systems have extremely high voltage. We're talking tens of thousands of volts of electricity. Even with the system partially disabled, you have to work at it to expose yourself to radiation or to the lasers. You have to act in a foolish way. But with electricity, all you have to be is careless. To paraphrase Winston Churchill, nothing in life is so exhilarating as to have 70,000 volts of electricity arc into the chassis in front of you at arm's length without result. Here's some of the hazards that you might not have considered. The last two are very common for us. A lot of the parts in the systems that we work on are very heavy. When you remove the last fastener holding it on the system, you have to make sure that you're holding on to the part, otherwise it could drop and either damage the part or damage another part of the system. And we also move a lot of data in these systems. So x-rays and CT scans and MR scans are just, they're big detailed image files. The O-arm imaging system that I showed you earlier, in a single 3D spin, it'll take hundreds of images, somewhere between 350 and 750 images. And you might need to take multiple spins in a single case. So we're moving a lot of data, and you can see that a data interruption might have some bad effects, obviously, and it might not be evident until the system is in use. In a topic-based authoring environment, reuse admonitions provide a consistent message with a consistent voice. The three-part admonition is more of a style guide thing for us, but the content reuse just provides that many more opportunities for consistency. Our admonition consists of a signal word, which is warning or caution, then a description of the hazard, the potential harm from ignoring the admonition, and then methods to mitigate the hazard. Our safety information falls into two places in our docs. The safety section, where we put more general safety information, such as how to clean the system is heavy, don't drive it over your foot, that sort of thing. In the safety sections, we also describe personal protective equipment, such as lead vests for x-ray systems and protective goggles for laser systems. This content is also reused at the point that it's required in the procedure. And this is where FLAIR and our reuse strategy really begin to show us some benefits. We write the admonitions as either reusable snippets or blocks of content, and then FLAIR gives us two ways to implement this information. This is a screen capture of our SVN repository, showing you an example of one of our product silos. The structure is repeated for all of our product lines, and there's about a dozen in all right now. You can see the traditional trunk, branch, tag structure that we're using, and that's completely supported by FLAIR. Remember when I said when you hear silo, think project? Stealth Station S8 here at the top is the project, and then each manual in that project is listed as children underneath content. You can see our payload directory here. This holds all of our reusable content. And this is reusable blocks of content for procedures as well as warnings and cautions. And it's an excellent location to put admonitions that don't change, such as general safety information, that electrical safety, x-ray safety, those things that I was mentioning earlier. And you can see that the payload directory is a sibling of all of the manuals, so it's equally accessible by all of those projects. Under resources is, of course, the snippets directory, and we also put admonition information in that directory as well. In the snippets directory, we further segregate the admonitions into warnings and cautions. So why do we do this? We haven't found a good way to display the signal word in a snippet, which is part of the style, and we haven't found a good way to display that in the text of the snippet. So we need to keep them separated, and that makes it easier to track them down when we need to make changes. To give you an example of the scope of our admonitions, we have one procedure that has 49 warnings and 41 cautions. That's 90 opportunities to hurt yourself, a bystander, or the system. We can take two approaches to information here. For my sake, my developers just described these as connected and disconnected snippets. That is, snippets that are linked or connected to the content in the directory, and snippets that are disconnected from the content in the directory. A connected snippet is implemented exactly the way you would implement reusable content from the payload directory, and the disconnected snippet is what we describe as a good starting place. You place the snippet, you disconnect it from the content in the directory, and you're effectively pasting it into that location, and then you can customize it to fit in that particular context. So let's do pros and cons for connected snippets. Obviously, it's an easy way to reuse content. That's what we're all about here, is reuse. And it's an easy way to create a warnings and cautions section. All you do is you just pull in all the snippets and just plop them into that section. Cons, admittedly, admonitions are often slightly different from usage to usage. That example I described earlier, where we say that a part is heavy and to hold on to it to remove, and when you remove the last fastener. In one case, that might be a board or an enclosure, and in another, it might be an X-ray tube or a camera. So you have to be able to customize the language to the context. Occasionally, we get requests to provide all content of a certain type for review, and it can be more difficult to output snippets for review than it is for content blocks. Only slightly more difficult, but it is a disadvantage, so I wanted to mention it. And, of course, like I said earlier, formatting doesn't always shine through, so it can be confusing to some authors. For disconnected snippets, remember these are snippets that are basically the result of cut and paste. It's a good starting place. You're not really reusing at that point. You're just sort of cutting and pasting, but you go into it knowing that that's going to be your approach. And it's one of the pros is that the content can truly be customized to fit the context without generating a lot of one-off blocks of content. The cons, it really is just cut and paste at this point. From an architectural perspective, it's kind of a dull tool. Topic-based authoring is a very elegant solution, and I don't like doing something so inelegant in an elegant solution like that. I'm always convinced that there's a better way to do it. But there's also that saying that if it's silly but it works, it's not silly. So it works in some of these instances. You just have to be aware of some of the disadvantages. So I usually find a way to get past it. More importantly, it's disconnected from the content. So it's impossible to get those universal updates when you make a change to the admonition. You have to know where all that text is being used, and you have to be really creative with your searches to find it and make sure that you get it all updated. And then links inside the snippets are difficult if you're into that kind of thing. And as with the other snippets, it can be difficult to output for review. And admonitions as content blocks, these are really easy. You know, it follows the reuse strategy. Formatting is easy. Cross-references are easy. All that stuff is just easy, big easy button. And from a metadata perspective, it's just content. You don't really have to treat it any differently than any of your other content. It's just content. From the con perspective, I don't necessarily like embedding content, blocks of content within blocks of content, which is what you have to do sometimes, especially if an admonition falls somewhere in the middle of a block of content. The hierarchy of your reuse starts to get a little confusing. And it's also a larger, more complex file with more opportunities to customize based on your implementation. I'm thinking conditions and variables here. You can end up being a little too clever by half and end up putting yourself in a situation where you have a single block of content with a dozen conditions when it would have been easier to just copy the content 12 times and rename it and reuse it like that. One last word on safety. We watermark every procedure that goes out for review, and we have a pretty specific watermark here. Why do we do this? Obviously, it hasn't been reviewed, so we don't want anyone to have the impression that it is a released project. But digging just a little bit deeper, the procedure hasn't been tested yet, and part of the testing is ensuring that you have the proper safety instructions. A lot of the people that do the reviewing are field personnel, so it's not unreasonable for them to have a document in their hands that tells them how to do something, and they say, oh, hey, as long as I'm here, this is something that I need to do anyway, I'll just use this untested procedure. At least with the watermark, they have the responsibility of recognizing that it's a draft. The business classification on the watermark there, business restricted, it protects our intellectual property. It's a different kind of safety, obviously, but it protects our intellectual property. As a Medtronic employee, I'm trained to know what business restricted means and how to protect that intellectual property. And of course, all of this is supported by multiple output targets and flare. Your different reviewers have different needs at different times, obviously. Okay, effectiveness. What does that mean when we're talking about service documentation? Do the procedures do what they say they do? That is, does a particular procedure describe how to replace a part without veering off into the board level theory of how the part works? You might find that in a calibration section, but really it's not necessary. Think about the much maligned stereo instructions. Do you get acoustic theory and resonance diagrams of speaker cabinets and information on the impedance of a gold plug versus a brass plug? Or do you get a diagram that says which plug is speaker left and which plug is speaker right? Do the procedures have all the steps necessary? This isn't just everything you need to walk up to the system where it's parked in the corner and do the repair, but also things like branch steps, do until, if then, those sorts of things. We have a surprising number of those in our service documentation. And does it apply to all revisions of the system? Any system that's been in the field for any amount of time is going to have been updated, both with major and minor updates. And does your documentation take into account all of those updates? And then finally anticipated, well, not finally, but anticipated failure modes. We do SME reviews for both safety and effectiveness. And I'll give you a good example of how those reviews go sometimes. The electrical engineering SME says that you have to wear dielectric gloves while working in this area of the system because of a shock hazard. And that's good information to have, considering we're dealing with literally tens of thousands of volts of electricity. But the service engineer SME says it's impossible to manipulate all the little tiny nuts and bolts while you're wearing those big bulky gloves. When we wrote the procedure, we were using a system that was completely discharged with no batteries in it, and no one was wearing the gloves when we filmed the procedure. So it wasn't until they actually reviewed the procedure that the practical use was actually considered. Here's another, even more practical measure of effectiveness. Can we, as a technical writer, or as a technical writing team, follow the procedure? I was leaving for lunch one afternoon and found one of my writers had completely disassembled this so she could take pictures of the individual parts on the inside, and there's a lot of parts in there. And she had used the manual that she had written to take the system apart and then put it back together again. So I think that that's a pretty good measure of effectiveness. More here, write once, use many. We've all worked in places where you don't use a topic-based authoring approach. And how many different ways do you have for powering on a system? Even if all the steps are there, they're never identical, right? You might have a dozen different ways to do the same 10 steps. And then determining the best possible approach to doing something and then reusing that approach for similar procedures. You're developing a paradigm, if you will, for repairing that particular system and even that particular family of systems. Everything you need from step one to the end, we talked about that. A single voice across all documents. Your style guide is going to drive that, but flair and its reuse just reinforces that. This approach will help you develop a standard and a consistent language. So wrench versus driver, screw versus bolt, that sort of thing. This is a good example from our own style guide. A wrench is a tool used to apply torque to a fastener for the purposes of tightening or loosening the fastener. Versus a driver, it's a tool used to apply downward pressure and torque to a fastener for the purpose of tightening and loosening the fastener. Now, you're going to be told that this language isn't consistent even among different manufacturers, and that's true, but it doesn't have to be true for you. And your reuse and your consistency can bring a consistent message, and your reuse with flair can support that consistency. Okay, remember this guy? I previously asked what these are. I think someone said spanner. A slick wrench? Okay. None of those were the answer I was anticipating. We had a huge argument in my shop, in my department, over channel locks.
Adjustable wrench,
okay. When we were having the discussion, channel lock is only partially correct. Channel lock is actually the name of the company that produces this tool, and the name of the tool, according to channel lock, is tongue and groove pliers. So would it surprise you to know, it might or it might not, to know that Irwin Tools, the company that produces vice grip pliers, also produces a similar tool they call groove joint pliers. And would it surprise you to know that Irwin Tools vice grips aren't the only locking joint pliers on the market? You can go down to your home improvement store and you can buy a pair of locking joint pliers made by Milwaukee or Husky. So where I'm from, we all pretty much know what we mean when we say channel locks or vice grips. But what about the service engineer in Southeast Asia or Norway or Texas, for that matter? You can't depend on everyone worldwide knowing what you mean when you say channel locks. They may come back from the store with these, channel lock slip joint pliers. The effectiveness of your documentation is enhanced by the common language. And one of the best ways to have a common language is understanding your system, understanding your tool set, and insisting on precise and reusable language. We talked a lot about topic-based authoring and FLAIR and how it can promote safety and effectiveness, but it's not all kittens and sunshine. This approach does have its drawbacks. And so how can FLAIR help address these issues? First of all, topic-based authoring is a difficult concept because, as we said, it diverges from the traditional approach. If a writer is having issues wrapping their head around the idea of topic-based authoring, use the tool to break down the task into smaller tasks. You're not writing a procedure for replacing a board. You're writing a procedure for how to safely power down the machine, and then come back to me when you're done. Now you're writing a procedure for how to remove that cover. Come back to me when you're done, and so forth. You can leverage FLAIR's ability to write a single block of content completely disconnected from any procedure. Next, it's easy to get overwhelmed by the amount of content, and so this is the same issue. Break it down to some simple, basic component tasks. Unlike FrameMaker, topic-based authoring and FLAIR don't require you to write your procedure from one to the end. You can break it down, make it a little more granular, and you can keep them busy, and it'll eventually click with them. And of course, a rigorous approach to assembly and tracking where content is used. As someone who used a spreadsheet to track where content is reused, let me just say you don't want to use a spreadsheet to track where content is being reused. This is what FLAIR does. Trust the technology. Let it do what it does well. Minor changes to content require additional cross-checks. There's no such thing anymore as just change that line. Everything is interconnected, so you can't just make these small changes. You have to be able to answer the question, what other procedures, what other documents are being impacted, and does that change drive a retest? The link viewer can help with this. When I view links for a particular block of content, the linked from window shows me where all that content is reused. If anyone from MadCap is here, I'm not sure if they are or not, but make the linked from list an exportable report. This list drives scoping activities. Here we see a block of content describing how to remove a panel, and it's reused in 13 different procedures. And this is a small manual with less than 50 procedures in it. So the list is really important when you're communicating to management what the scope of that very minor change is. So having the list is good, but rather than having to rekey it, if there was a way to print this list out, that would be awesome. In our organization, we have project managers that run the project. Usually the tech writers don't run the project because they are so large with some heavy scheduling demands. The project manager, they do everything from scheduling to hardware allocation for the testing. My writers have gotten so efficient that we're now outpacing that support system. And this is a good problem to have for a couple of different reasons. No one wants to be the long pole in a documentation project. You don't want to be the reason why a project runs 7 months instead of five. And it allows you to work ahead, and it gives you some slack time when you have to go back and retest a dozen different procedures for one minor change. Unfortunately, you can also get far enough ahead of your schedule that it looks like you're sitting idle. And we should be able to do more, but instead we're sitting and we're waiting for those resources to catch up to us. High efficiency is not always the best optics. Okay, let's wrap it up here. We talked about how safety is important when servicing machines that can injure you if you're not careful, and how Flare supports reuse of the safety information from a couple of different strategies for that reuse. For us, safe and effective that we strive for, it protects the field engineer, it protects bystanders, property, and of course the system, and it stays on point. Reusability enhances the consistency of voice and the consistency of message, especially in the admonitions where consistency is very important. And the tool supports multiple review cycles for different audiences and their different needs. Effective documentation provides one way of doing things, the way, and it provides everything the field engineers needs from step one until step N. Reusability provides a consistent language, especially in terminology. And Flare is great for breaking down large tasks into individual writing efforts. Of course, write once, use many. That's the heart of reuse, universal updates. That goes without saying. Hockey stick productivity curve. That's a big management phrase, but what it really means is by the time you're about halfway through with your documentation set, you're really only writing 10 to 20% of any given procedure because you've already written the rest of it. You're just writing the stuff in the middle of it. So, as a measure of efficiency, in fiscal year 2016, three writers on my team published only 806 pages of documentation using FrameMaker. In fiscal year 2017, those same three writers published almost 11,000 pages of documentation using Flare. Like I said, I started out thinking that's pretty impressive. I'm not so sure it is now, but for our group, it really blew away our management team when I showed them this. And it really justified the money and the time that we spent on investing in this tool and this approach. Okay, what questions do you have for me? Sir? Sure. So the question was, in a service organization, you might have veterans that have different ways of doing things, and how do you ensure that the veterans are following your instructions and not going rogue and doing things their own way and closing that loop back to what we have written and updating those procedures? Yeah, so that is something that we struggle with. It's something that our service organization is a very mature organization in terms of how long it's been alive. It's a very immature organization in terms of actually having service documentation. The documentation team is only a couple of years old, and we're going to those senior people and saying, how is it that you do what you do? Let us write it down. Let us take advantage of your knowledge so that we can help everyone else do it. We don't have a good method other than a channel for them to get information back to us. We have an issues list, and so those issues come back to us. We put them in our we scope them for the next release, and we make those updates. But really, it's the honor system. This is, you're just depending on them to follow the documentation. The good part of that is that they are veterans, right? So they might have a better way to do it, and while it might not be the way we want them to do it, it is generally safe because they're still with us, and is generally effective because they're getting the job done, right? So that's more of a cultural thing than it is anything else. We're providing that method to get information back to us, but it is difficult to enforce that on a worldwide basis. We don't have a good method for it. We want to. We're not there yet. We are outputting to PDF right now, and these manuals are our shortest ones are 750 to 800 pages. Our longest ones are over 2,300 pages long. So doing videos for all of our procedures, it's very difficult. And then you have the requirements of. There's a quality requirement, big Q quality department requirement, that anything that's in a video has to exactly and precisely match what was tested. And so that can be very difficult. You can't do those videos in the moment that you're recording them. You've got to go back and do them at another time. We're looking at moving towards an electronic service manual, and that's certainly one of the things that we want to do, but we still have some quality issues that we need to overcome. You, sir.
And maybe I should listen up a little bit, but you're describing, you know, the style approach, and I understand revisions and tracking and goes. But when you get to like a global level, how often do you update a global project, and then how often does that feed into the author's individual workflow?
Okay. So the question is, how often are we updating our global projects, and how does that feed into the rest of the release cycle for the documents? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
So I have a technical team lead who is responsible for that global project. And she, early on, was making updates to that on a daily basis. And now it's more of a monthly or even a quarterly basis. The release of our documents, we are on about a six-month cadence, depending on how many projects we're releasing, or I'm sorry, how many procedures in a manual we're releasing, and the testing. So we can update the global project up until the time we build the book. We've tried to take a very strong line on the separation between data and presentation, and that global project is very presentation oriented, so it has very little impact on the actual data. The data can't change after it's been tested. That's that review cycle. But the presentation, no one really cares. Well, I don't want to say no one. Quality doesn't necessarily care about the presentation. They want to make sure that the data is identical to what was tested. So we can update that global project up until the minute that we hit the build button. We haven't made that effort yet. My technical team lead, if you happen to find Trish Edwards walking around, she is my Flare lead, and she's definitely a rock star. So she can tell you more about our own implementation. What you're talking about is not something that we have in the works right now. Yeah, back there. Yep. So the question is, how do you, while you're testing the procedures, simulate the environment that they're going to be in? When we test the procedures, we have a standardized toolkit, and we make sure that they have the standardized toolkit and the procedure. Other than that, there's not a good way to simulate rolling around on the floor. You know, the best way to test it is to just say, here's the tools you're supposed to have. You're not supposed to have any other tools, so you can't use any other tools. And then we have observers that they observe step by step the procedures as they're being, the steps in the procedure as it's being done, and then they initial each step that it's been completed according to the procedure. There was something else I was going to say in regard to that that escapes me at the moment. This, so that the O-arm that I showed you, the one with the big circular gantry, that system actually weighs upwards of a ton. And we have one procedure where you have to lift the front of it and kick some wooden chocks underneath the front wheels so that you can change those front wheels. And so we've had engineers in the field say that they just go out to the rental car and they pull the scissor jack out of the trunk and they use that to lift the front. Well, scissor jack from the rental car is not on the approved tools list. So we had to come up with a way with our environmental health and safety department on how to actually lift the front of that thing, kick some phone books, which are also not on the approved list, but are ubiquitous, and we had to test just how to lift the front of that system. So the best way to describe it is just limiting them to the tools that they're supposed to have and limiting them to only the procedure, the steps in the procedure. And if they're doing other things, then, you know, we have to go back and assess, do we need to add those, or are they things that they need to take out? Anyone else? Yeah, use.
With that big O-arm machine, do you send a typewriter out on site when a repair person is working on it to take notes, or do you rely on notes from people who are out in the field, non-typewriters?
So the question is, do we send tech writers into the field to observe repairs while they're being done? And the answer to that is generally no. These systems are being repaired inside a hospital, usually behind doors that the general public is not allowed beyond. They're being done in operating rooms or just outside of operating rooms. And to be allowed into those areas of a hospital, there's a big, long list of shots that you have to have. And it can be a 6 to 8 month process to be put in a position where you can get certification so that a hospital will allow you to go back into those areas to observe. So we generally rely on the engineer in the field to send stuff back to us and say, there's a better way to do this, this is completely wrong. We don't get a lot of this is completely wrong because of the level of testing that we've gone to. It's usually gone through a minimum of 3 complete test sessions before it's published. So it's usually pretty tight. It's usually people rushing through it or not having the proper tools that causes the problems with it. But we try to be very good about allowing people to send that feedback to us and making sure that we have a good assessment of what changes need to be made. But the specific answer to your question is no, we generally don't send people out into the field. Yes, ma'am. So the question is, how do you maintain a list of keywords, regardless of what they are? A lot of that is tribal knowledge, and it's just I have some good people that have a lot of experience with these systems. They're generally fairly monogamous with one system, so they understand it fairly well. They understand the tools, and I have made them advocates for us so that when the service engineer says channel locks, they know that they can push back and say, I know what you're talking about there, and this is what I'm going to say because it's the proper tool that we use. And then they fall back on our style guide and say, we've already had this discussion, and people from your department were involved with it, and here's the decision. You know. And so I empower my writers to be the SMEs for the document, just like the electrical engineer is the SME when it comes to the electrical system, or the mechanical engineer is the SME when it comes to the physical systems on the system. My writers are no less important than all of those people, and they have an area of expertise. They advocate for themselves and for our department. And so the people that we work with have gotten a pretty good feel for what they can push back on and what they can't. In the future, we're looking at exactly that same thing. And one of the things that we're looking at is utilizing either the dictionary or the thesaurus in FLAIR as a way to suggest the proper word. You know, when you see channel lock, suggest tongue and groove plier. When you see umbilical, suggest interconnect, that sort of thing. We're looking at ways to use the tool to implement that, but it's a low priority because we have a pretty good handle on what that language is supposed to be already. Anyone else? All right. Thanks, everyone. I really appreciate it.